Chapter 20 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 20. This prosecution of Oscar Wilde never had any moral force behind it, and as a result it produced nothing but a crop of evil and calamity. It was dictated by vengeance and hypocrisy, unaccompanied by any genuine moral purpose. The man who brought it about, although his direct part in the proceedings ceased after his acquittal at the Old Bailey, was an immoral man, a bad father and a worse husband, an avowed atheist, a man who did not scruple to sacrifice his own son and break the heart of his long-suffering wife simply to gratify his feelings of revenge and his passion for notoriety. As exemplifying my father's moral attitude towards the whole business, I may state that after Oscar Wilde's conviction, he wrote to me offering, if I would give up Wilde forever, to supply me with money and an allowance, and suggesting that I should go to the South Sea Islands, where, he said, you will find plenty of beautiful girls. His only idea of reformation was to substitute, as he supposed, one vice for another. If he had left me alone, and refrained from publishing the scandal to the whole world, my friendship with Wilde, which had already become quite harmless many months before the final catastrophe, would no doubt have gradually cooled off. It was not likely that I could have gone on indefinitely keeping up a sentimental friendship with a man whose ideas of what he describes in the unpublished part of De Profundis as his great love for me could yet allow him to live the kind of life of promiscuous nastiness with a dozen or more boy paramours which was revealed in his trial. The emotion of the great crisis fanned the waning fires of our devotion to each other. I was, before the trial, beginning to be a little tired of Oscar's goings-on, even allowing for the fact that he, of course, concealed his infidelities as much as he could. We had had several acrimonious quarrels. In the ordinary course of events, my infatuation for him would have worn out, and obviously his for me was a very much less enduring and tremendous affair than he himself imagined it to be. If it had not been so, he would scarcely have made such a complete volte-face in his attitude towards me after being in prison only 9 months. I do not blame my father for trying to separate me from Wilde, but I do blame him bitterly for the way he tried to do it, and for acting as he did when he found that his efforts at separating us were unavailing. It is, and I defy anyone to say the contrary, perfectly obvious that he was not thinking of me and my interests when he created the scandal which ruined my life, and also, to a great extent, what was left of his own. For his spectacular victory at the Old Bailey did my poor father no good. He was, metaphorically speaking, pursued by furies ever afterwards up to the time of his last illness. A great number of people of his own class, who did not bother their heads over much about what happened to Queensbury's boy after his father had ruined him, yet definitely drew the line from that time forth at Queensbury himself. He was cut by many of his oldest friends, and politely cold-shouldered by others. My godfather, dear old Lord Robert Bruce, I am called, as my second name, Bruce, after him, who was in the Navy with my father, and up till then one of his greatest friends, told me himself, years after, that he never spoke to my father again after what he had done. He was forever estranged from his son and heir, my brother Percy, and from Percy's wife and children. And though he received me back into favour for a short time, about a year before his death, our reconciliation did not last long. After formally forgiving me and embracing me with tears many times in the smoking room of Bailey's Hotel, where he was then staying, promising me my allowance back again, and actually writing to his cousin, Arthur Douglas, who managed his affairs to that effect, and calling me my poor darling boy, he whipped round on me again and wrote me an abusive letter in which he said that he did not intend to give me a penny until he knew exactly what my relations were with that beast wild. This was quite gratuitous, as I had already explained in a letter to my cousin Algy Bourke, the Honourable Algernon Bourke, brother of the late Lord Mayo, exactly what those relations were, and he had shown my letter to my father, who had thereupon expressed a desire to see me and receive me back into favour. What happened was, precisely, that I wrote to Algy Bourke from Paris and told him that I should like to make friends with my father again, and I asked him to try to arrange it. I told Algy that I was ready to express contrition for what I had done, but, I said, I cannot undertake not to see Wilde from time to time. I can, however, give you and my father my word that my relations with him are entirely harmless, and only dictated by my feeling that I cannot abandon him now that he is poor and broken, after being his friend when he was rich and flourishing. I went on to say that I was sure my father would appreciate the situation, that my intercourse with Wilde was chiefly confined to helping him financially whenever I could, and that I had already given my word of honour to my mother that I would never live in the same house with him or sleep under the same roof with him again. I had given this promise to my mother when I left Wilde in my villa at Naples. In return for the promise, my mother gave me £200 to give to Wilde. I went on to say to Algy that I must ask my father to consider the sort of dog's life I have had for the last few years and to meet me halfway, and not make it impossible for me to bring about the reconciliation which I so sincerely desired. Algy, kindest and most untiringly good-natured of men, immediately approached my father, showed him my letter, and wrote to me within 24 hours to say that it was all right, and that my father would be delighted to see me, and had spoken in the most affectionate way about me. The interview I have described took place between us. This must have been in 1898, I think. The reconciliation lasted only about a week, and came to an end when my father wrote in the terms I have described. I made a suitable reply, in which I said that it was obvious that there was no possibility of any lasting peace between us, and once more hurling back the celebrated and legendary allowance with stinging words. Very wrong and stupid of me, no doubt. If I had had enough tact, I would have said nothing, and allowed my father to come round again in his own way. But in those days I had no sense, and I was, moreover, ill in bed with influenza at my mother's house, 18 Cadogan Place, when my father's letter arrived. I worked myself into a fever over it, and replied in terms calculated to make the breach irreparable. My father was, I believe, very much upset by my letter. I saw him again only once in the street many months later. I was in a cab. I was struck with compunction at his appearance, for he looked ill and wild and haggard. I ascertained from my brother-in-law, St. George Fox Pitt, who was about the only member of the family who was at that time on speaking terms with him, that he was under the impression that I hated him, and that I was responsible for certain purely imaginary troubles from which he was suffering. He told my brother-in-law that he was being persecuted by the Oscar Wilders, and that they had driven him out of various hotels, and disturbed him at nights by shouting abusive epithets at him. I felt dreadfully upset about all this, and, as it was quite obvious that my father was suffering from delusions, it struck me that the best thing I could do to remove them was to write to my brother-in-law a letter which I asked him to show my father. In this letter I said that my father was completely mistaken in imagining that I hated him, or had any feelings about him except of kindness and affection. I explained that the last letter I had written to him was provoked by his own, which had reached me when I was in a high fever from influenza, and that I was scarcely responsible for what it contained, and in any case did not mean what I said, and entirely withdrew it. I also sent him my love. St. George gave my letter to my father. He read it, and it undoubtedly calmed his mind and put a stop to his delusions about persecutions. He made no comment on the letter, but my brother-in-law said, I think he was pleased to see it. Not long afterwards he died, at the early age of 53. My uncle Archie, a Catholic priest, wrote me 12 years later, after I became a Catholic, a letter in which he told me that before my father died, a cloud seemed to lift off his spirit. He entirely renounced his agnostic views and professed his love for and faith in Jesus Christ, to whom, he said, I have confessed all my sins. My uncle gave him conditional absolution, and he died happily and peacefully. My dear mother visited him just before his death, and he assured her she was the only woman he had ever loved. May his soul rest in peace. In spite of the hard things I have been compelled to say about him, I have got back much of my old love for him as I had it when I was a child. Needless to say, I have never ceased to pray for him, and I look forward confidently to seeing him hereafter in a better world than this, when all misunderstandings and obstacles to love and knowledge will be removed forever. End of chapter 20.